Welcome to the My Buddy Green podcast. I'm Jason Wachob, founder and co-CEO of My Buddy Green, and your host. Hey, everyone. Now, it's no secret that the health and well-being space is filled with conflicting opinions and controversies, but I think we all can agree that a sense of happiness is a very good thing for your health. And according to Dr. Bob Waldinger, happiness can even help you live longer. Dr. Bob is a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and Zen practitioner who currently runs the longest study of adult life that's ever been done. Yes, you heard that right. He is the director of the 85-year-long Harvard Study of Adult Development, where he investigates over 2,000 participants to answer the following question: what makes a good life? Now, in today's episode, Dr. Bob tells us everything you need to know about living a life full of purpose, happiness, and health. A true must listen you'll definitely want to share with your friends. Bob, welcome.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. I really enjoyed your new book, The Good Life. So it's really exciting for me to have you on the show. And you know, you've got an interesting background. So why don't we start there by telling folks a bit about your background and the work you do?
Sure. I'm a psychiatrist. I am a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Med School. And I run the longest study of adult life that's ever been done. But in addition, my specialty in psychiatry is psychotherapy, is talk therapy. So I do that every day. I teach it to psychiatry trainees. And the other thing I do, which is really important in my life, is I'm a serious Zen practitioner.
Well, a lot to like there, but specifically the most interesting thing about you is the soundbite of, I've run the longest study ever done. But before we go there, because we're going to spend a significant portion of our time there, I do want to start with the title of the book. It is The Good Life. And how would you describe, quote unquote, the good life and what that means? Let's go there first.
This is a small, simple question, right? I think for me, the good life involves being involved in things that you care about and being involved with people who you care about and who care about you.
Well said. I like that. And what led you to this title and what we're going to spend a lot of our time today is this Harvard Study of Scientific Development, which began in 1938 and is still ongoing and you are running, which is fascinating. So can you summarize this study and its significance?
Sure. What's unique about the study is that we've studied the same people over and over again, year after year, through their whole adult lives. Starting with them as teenagers, following them, we're in our 85th year. Some of our original people are still alive, just a few of them. They're in their late 90s or early 100s. We started with them when they were somewhere between the ages of like 10 and 19 years old.
Wow. And how long have you personally been involved?
20 years. I started in 2002.
And how many participants from start to today?
Originally 724 boys and young men. Then we expanded to all their wives, and then we expanded to their children, 1,315 of them. So now it's well over 2,000 people that we've studied.
And so a lot's obviously happened in the 80 plus years of this study. But before we jump to the findings, what changed in terms of how the study was conducted? Give people a little insight into what this looked like. Did you check in every, 3 to 6 months, ask them some questions, do some tests? Like, what did this look like then? And what does this look like now?
We started out back then in 1938 doing interviews, extensive interviews with each young man. Also medical exams, elaborate skull and body measurements, because in 1938, they thought that the shape of your skull and your body habitus determined your intelligence and your personality. Like, we don't think that anymore, but it's not proven to be true, but that's what they thought. So medical exams, social exams, we went to their homes and interviewed their parents, and researchers actually made notes about what was being served for dinner and the disciplinary style of the parents. So all these kind of social aspects were recorded. And then over time, we are kind of a history of science project in a way, because we added things. We added audio tape. We added videotape. We started recently drawing blood for DNA, which is so cool because if you think about it, in 1938, DNA wasn't even imagined. And here we are doing DNA analyses. We put people into the MRI scanner and watch their brains light up as we show them different kinds of pictures. So we've really added things, methods, as we go, but we're studying the same big things that we started studying in 1938, like mental health, physical health, work relationships, social relationships.
And ultimately happiness. And so what's changed? Walk us through what happiness looked like 80 plus years ago to today.
Happiness wasn't a thing 80 plus years ago. I mean, we didn't talk about it in the same way. I mean, I expect people may have, but first of all, we didn't ask about it. Our participants didn't talk about it. They talked about how they were living their lives. They talked about their work lives, their personal lives, their families, a lot about family. And so the idea of seeking happiness, seeking personal happiness, not much of a thing back then.
So does that lead you to believe we've changed as a species, or modernization has led us to become more unhappy? Or what's the conclusion you draw? If it wasn't something we looked at 80 plus years ago, and then today there's no shortage of studies on happiness, books on happiness. You look at the statistics, we're more unhappy than ever. What do you think's changed?
Well, I think the issues haven't changed so much in terms of whether or not people are happy, but it's really how people think about their lives. I mean, people thought about their lives more with respect to having purpose. Right? Like, am I supporting my family? Am I being a good partner? Am I being a good parent? Am I being a good member of society? So it was much more about those ways of thinking about one's life. I think in the last 40 years or so, people have begun to ask about happiness. I think partly because we began to understand that our society is not happier just because gross domestic product is going up, that economic progress does not mean an increase in happiness. And that once we began to realize that, we started studying it more rigorously and studying the difference between economic well-being and personal happiness.
So you've mentioned family a couple times. How important is family? Is it about the depth and strength of that familial relationship or any relationship? Does it matter that it's family? Is it more important to have a really strong, deep relationship with someone versus family?
I think it's the former. I think what really matters is that you have a strong, deep relationship with somebody, and that it doesn't have to be a relative. So I'll give you an example. At one point, we asked our original participants, who could you call in the middle of the night if you were sick or scared? List everybody you could call. Some people could list quite a few people. Some people couldn't list a soul, not one person on the planet. And some of those people who couldn't list anybody were married. So,
Not good for that marriage.
Not good. So one of the things I think we've come to see is that having somebody who you feel really has your back, will be there for you when you're in trouble, when you're hurting, when you're scared, that seems to be essential for well-being.
So in terms of relationships and their role in happiness, there are various theories on the critical number one needs. Is there a number in your opinion?
No, it's highly individual. So, you know, we're all on some kind of continuum from being shy, introverted, to being very extroverted. And depending on where we are, if I'm an extrovert, I get my energy from other people. So I want a lot of people around me. If I'm an introvert, a lot of people are exhausting and draining and stressful. So for me, having very few people in my life is really the sweet spot. And I think all of us vary in how many people we need. So there is no particular number.
So we do vary. And as I think about this study in the 80 plus years, in my view, happiness, from my personal experience, definitely changes as we age. What did you find in the study in terms of happiness through the teens all the way through the 80s?
It does, because biologically we're so different and psychologically, right? So, you know, happiness when you're a kid is so different from when you're a teenager. You know, going through puberty, happiness is really different. You've got this upsurge of hormones and sexual energy and this opening up cognitively of the world. And so happiness is so different from when you're six, right? And what you really want is candy and games. And then what we know is that as people get older, the fact of mortality becomes more real. So literally about in midlife, like around your mid-40s, we all begin to have this dawning awareness that this mortality thing is out there waiting for us. And that, yeah, we've all known it intellectually before, but you really begin to get it. And that awareness that time is short, that time is limited, begins to shape what we do and what we prioritize. It actually makes us prioritize more the moment-to-moment well-being, and it makes us prioritize doing what's really important to us, being with the people who are really important to us, more than we did in our 20s, say, for example.
In terms of the study, what were some of the biggest takeaways for you?
There were two big ones. You know, we've published hundreds of papers and many books, but the two big takeaways are, first of all, that taking care of your health really matters. No surprise, but boy, our data are so powerful in showing that, in fact, eating well, not becoming obese, exercising regularly, getting health care, getting enough sleep, not abusing alcohol and drugs, all those things that your mother told you, right, turn out to be hugely important for staying healthy longer and living longer. So that's the finding that wasn't a surprise. The finding that was a surprise was about our connections. The idea that people who were more connected and had warmer connections to others stayed healthier longer and they lived longer.
So when you mentioned warmer connections, we discussed having that list of people to go to in the middle of the night when you're in trouble. What about the weaker links, if you will, the casual relationship, like the conversation one might have with their local barista? Do casual relationships matter at all?
They turn out to matter. We didn't think they did, but people have begun to study this very systematically, and it turns out they do. That the people you might see every day, but don't really know that well, or the people you might see once a week, the person who's the cashier at the supermarket where you buy your groceries, that when you exchange some pleasant words with those people, you get little hits of well-being. You get little hits of happiness that turn out to be important for our sense that life is good.
So the reality is, if you have one go-to person, whether that's your life partner or a really good friend, and casual conversation on a daily basis with a barista or whomever it might be in your life, you could be okay in terms of your happiness.
It depends on you, right? So what if you need more people than that? Then you might want more. But you're right. Those are kind of some of the basics, particularly that go-to person and some people in the world who remind you that of who you are and where you live, the person who delivers your mail, who you say hello to, those kinds of people.
And without going down the rabbit hole of technology, and social media. But at the same time, I'd be remiss not to mention, what role do you think technology and social media is playing with regards to our happiness and relationships and possibly distorted view?
Well, we're all worried about that. And there's a lot more research that we need to do about how social media affects us. But there are some findings that might be useful here. It seems that when we use social media actively to connect with people, that that often makes us feel better and enhances our well-being. And when we use social media passively, like scrolling through somebody else's Instagram feed, that that often makes us compare ourselves to others. It's a recipe for lower self-esteem, more anxiety, more depression, right? So active connection online versus passive consumption.
Why is comparison so dangerous?
And it is. Boy, they've done rigorous studies now. Like the more often in a given day that we compare ourselves to others, the less happy we are. It's amazing. Probably the reason comes from something one of my Zen teachers told me once. She once said, we're always comparing our insides to other people's outsides. So other people show up as they are, right? They show up showing us what they want to usually about their lives. We curate our lives for each other, you know, all day long. I mean, you and I are being on our best behavior right now here, right? Pretty much, you know, you don't get to see me when I'm annoyed or depressed or cranky, right? And because we're not doing that with each other, and that's good. But what if I just imagined that you were never sad, you were never uncertain, you were never worried, because I never see that in your life. It makes me compare myself negatively. So comparison is often an unrealistic comparison, because I compare what I know about myself and my life, which is the full richness of it, with the little bit that I know about someone else.
So with that said, you know, culturally, I think we're at an interesting place where if you were to poll Gen Z, and this is a real poll, a significant percentage wanted to become influencers as a career choice. So I think about people are pursuing notoriety, being celebrated in public, material success, monetary success, and not that those things are wrong and one should not pursue them, but do you see an issue with setting goals tied to those things and set at odds with our happiness?
It's not at odds with our happiness. It's just different, right? So there are some people who get really rich and they are happy, and some people who get really rich and are miserable.
So why is that? Why is that?
Because wealth is empty. Like, you can't even eat it. You can't keep warm with it, right? It's just kind of what you do with your life that matters, right? So you could have a lot of wealth and do terrible things or just not do anything. You could have no wealth but do wonderful things in the world that make you happy and benefit the world, right? So wealth is just one vehicle. Fame, similarly, you know, fame actually may be more likely to make you unhappy, because fame is having a lot of people know who you are, have fantasies about you, but not really know you. And often then you're no longer anonymous. If you're really famous, you can't walk down the street with other people wanting to have contact with you, maybe when you don't feel like it. So these things, it's not that they are bad for us, it's just that they don't bring happiness. And so the people who get fame and wealth and Nobel Prizes turn around and say, yeah, but that didn't make me happy, it was supposed to.
Well, how much of this comes back to comparison? You know, I heard something recently. It was a study mentioned on my friend Andrew Huberman's podcast around happiness, and this idea of where comparison comes in. And I'll use wealth as an example, and I think it was one that he used, where, let's say, if you are relatively affluent and you are surrounded by people who are of the same level of wealth maybe a little bit lower, you are more likely to be happier than if you're affluent, maybe even more affluent than the first example, but surrounded by people with extraordinary wealth, where all of a sudden, all the fancy bells and whistles you can afford don't mean as much because this person even has more than you. And that, can we talk? I thought that was so interesting.
I think because it inspires fantasies of what life is like for those other people, those super, super wealthy people, right? The idea that, well, okay, I'm really comfortable here in my nice house, in my nice neighborhood, but those people have got so much more. That must be great, right? And really what we're talking about, and I think we talk about this a lot in the book, that everybody has difficulties in their life. Everybody struggles with things. That there's no person on the planet who doesn't have bad days and who doesn't have stressful challenges, right? But we imagine that somewhere somebody's got it made and somebody gets to a place where they no longer have troubles in their life. And what, you know, what I know from studying thousands of people and from my own life is that's just not the truth of anybody's life.
So how do we all get more comfortable with where we are in life, with our health, with our relationships, with our wealth, with all of it, the whole kit and caboodle? How do we all become more comfortable and establish a reasonable baseline of happiness?
Well, here I'm going to go to my Zen practice. So one of the things that meditation does is it basically has you watch your life. It has you watch your mind and your body and watch everything that comes up moment after moment. And what happens over time is you really begin to accept, oh yeah, this is me too. And then there's this, and then this is coming up. And oh yeah, that's part of my life too. And it's just this kind of exercise in constantly watching the unfolding of your life and hopefully coming to more self-acceptance in the process.
And if your Zen practice and meditation, it sounds like, has played a role for you, and I applaud that, and something we've talked about in this show, I think mindfulness-based practice is huge. What's something one should not do that is absolutely detrimental to their happiness? Is it comparison? Is there something else? What are the things we should try to avoid at all costs?
Well, yeah. I mean, comparison is hard to avoid. We can't avoid it. I compare myself, and then hopefully I catch myself sooner rather than later. I would say social isolation is probably the biggest thing to try to avoid. And that's a harder one because there are a lot of lonely people. There are a lot of isolated people. And so I think that paying more attention to our social connections is really important to avoid that. That's actually one of the reasons why we wrote the book.
Loneliness epidemic we're experiencing right now. And loneliness, as we know, is equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. That's insane. Think about that for a moment.
Exactly. And also as detrimental to your health as being obese.
So to the point you were making, that is a huge issue right now. But how does one get out of it?
That's a really key question. There are things we can do, but it's not always easy. Some people are really afraid of connecting with others. They're afraid of rejection. They're afraid that people can't be trusted. There's so many reasons that many people are worried about trying to connect. On the other hand, there are things we can do. One of the things they do is they study, like, how do relationships start? How do people form relationships? And what they know is that if you put yourself in situations where you encounter the same people repeatedly, you're more likely to strike up a conversation and you're more likely to continue conversations or deepen them. And so one of the things people can do, for example, is think about things they care about and see if there are ways to volunteer or do something in the world related to something you care about and do it with other people, because then you have something you both care about, you have something in common, and you're more likely to rub elbows over and over again at a, you know, a political campaign or working for you know, to prevent climate change, or a gardening club, or a bowling league, doesn't matter what it is. You know, just find something you love and see if you can do it and do it alongside other people.
And in terms of the world we live in today, you know, many companies like ours are remote first cultures where people can live and work all over the world. And that's incredible for flexibility. It's fantastic for working moms and dads. It's a great to attract world-class talent, regardless of location. And it gives people a lot of flexibility, which is amazing. I'm a big proponent of it. We embrace it at MindBodyGreen. With all that said, something I personally miss, I don't know if our employees miss it, is the energy of the office and the spontaneous connections, you know, at the coffee bar in the morning and random conversations. And I think this is a cultural shift. You know, I know that many companies are attempting to drag employees back to the office, and some are successful at that, others not. But I fundamentally do think it's a shift. And I do think about all of the IRL spontaneous connection that was part of the office. And I see that as, I guess, fundamentally lost. And I'm a little sad when I think about it. But I'm also at a life stage where not as critical to me. What do you think about that and generationally the shift we're just seeing there?
So many of us are worried about this for just the reasons you're describing. And, you know, we don't know what gets filtered out. We know that in-person interaction is different. Like if you remember the experience of coming together with people after you kind of got out of lockdown during the pandemic, and this upsurge of energy, like this was so amazing to be together again. Like, we know that stuff gets filtered out online. We also know that online connection is way better than no connection. So then the question is, what's possible? And I think that many of us have to figure out how to engineer a kind of personal connection that would naturally happen in the office around the coffee machine. We may have to engineer it in meetings. So I'll give you an example. Vivek Murthy, our Surgeon General, he started something at his staff meetings where once a week, they have one person at the meeting take 5 minutes and just talk to the group about something in their personal life that they'd like people to know about. And people love this meeting. It's their favorite meeting. They look forward to it. They don't want to end this practice at all. And then what happens is it generates other conversations because people know about each other's lives. So that's just one small way, but it may be a way that we want to try to build in to have more personal connection, even if it's online.
So on that note, do you think that casual connection with the neighbor has changed since the 1930s to where we are today?
Well, I know it's changed since the 1930s because they've done some good studies of this. There's a sociologist named Robert Putnam. He wrote a book called Bowling Alone, which was a study of what he calls social capital. Like, how much do we invest in our communities, in other people? How much do we go out for dinner with friends? How much do we go to churches or synagogues? How much do we join bowling leagues? And what he found was that starting in the 1950s, our investment in our communities plummeted. And you can probably guess what that coincided with in the United States, the 1950s. Well, I'll tell you, it's the introduction of television into the American home. Everybody stayed home. And then when he went back in the early 2000s to study this again, it had gone down again, our investments in each other, probably because of the advent of all these screens. And we think that that's what the big difference in the 1930s was that people were much more invested in community activities, in socializing.
Right, right. And now when we all socialize, as you know, I'll bring my iPhone on screen. You go out to dinner, the iPhones, the texting, the Instagramming.
Exactly. You see all these people sitting around a dinner table in a restaurant, and they're all on their phones, sometimes texting each other.
Yes. So you mentioned the churches, and something I find interesting is purpose and the role of believing in something bigger than oneself, whether that is an organized religion, whether it is anything. What role, in your opinion, does purpose and that belief in something greater than yourself play?
Well, they're different. So something greater than yourself is, it depends. You could mean a higher power, right? Or it could mean a collective well-being and the importance of community, right? So I'm not sure which one you...
Well, let's talk... That's actually a great distinction. Let's talk about both.
I will tell you that in terms of the higher power, we asked our participants, do you have a religious practice or a spiritual practice? Do you consider yourself spiritual? And it was about half and half. Many said no, not at all. And many said yes. And the people who had religious and spiritual practices were not happier than the people without them. They weren't less happy either. But they did say that when they turned to religion for solace during hard times, that it was a help. So that's what we know, at least from our study, about religion and spirituality.
And what about the collection, the collective well-being?
Collection, what we do know, and this is kind of a phase of adult development, that Eric Erickson, who you know was a psychologist who posited stages of adult development, and he said that there's a stage called generativity that we get to usually around midlife, where we really start caring about the larger world. We care about fostering the development of younger people, mentoring younger people, furthering causes that we want to thrive in the world, right? He said that's a really important part of a fulfilling life as we get older. And some of the empirical research that's been done shows that people who have a sense of purpose, like this is what my life's about, this is why I get up in the morning, those people live longer. So I think what you're pointing to, this idea of purpose, it matters a lot.
Well, I also think where the two come together, the higher power and the community, I think of the organized religion and the church, and the numbers are declining everywhere, with the exception, though, and I think this is interesting, these like mega churches in parts of the country where they're all like full service. They've got church, they've got sports, they've got facilities, they've got groups, they've got small groups, they got that group, they got baby, they have it all. That's the exception. Not my cup of tea per se, but I think it's fascinating.
Well, and I think it provides community, right? It's the antidote to bowling alone. And it may be that many people are less concerned about matters of faith than they are about joining a community that's vibrant and provides things for adults and kids and all the services you're describing.
So in a sense, as I've described, there's so many books on happiness and there are hacks and there are studies, but what I'm hearing to some degree, if maybe I'm just projecting here, but it feels like maybe we're a little bit too focused on the self here, other than taking care of our well-being, and it's more about others and connection.
Yes, yes. We are very individualistic, as you know. The American myth is of the kind of self-made man, and it's always a man, who's self-made, and it's a total myth. But one of the things we find is that the people who are more concerned about others are the people who end up, who are happier as they go. The people who take care of others. In fact, the Dalai Lama has a great quote. He says, the wise, selfish person takes care of other people.
Love it. That's a good one. So you mentioned myths. What are some of the other myths you've come across in terms of how we measure happiness? Or look at happiness more generally.
Well, one myth is that you could be happy all the time and that you just need to attain the right things or just do the right stuff, do the right practices, and you'll be happy all the time. And therefore, if you're not happy all the time, you're doing something wrong. That is a total myth. Nobody's happy all the time. Not one human being on the planet. But it can be something that we accidentally sell to each other as a kind of ideal that's completely unattainable.
And what is most concerning to you in terms of the findings of the study? I'm sure you look at within the study, there's trends, there are trend lines. What trends are you most concerned about in looking at that study over the period of the 80 plus years?
I think the trends are more about social connection, that the decline in social connection, because we're pretty clear that human beings evolved to be socially connected, that we think literally it's about passing on your genes, that the people who were more likely to survive to pass on their genes were the people who operated in groups because it was safer. You could defend yourself better from the threats of the world. And so we are much better off in groups and with social connection than not. Isolation is a tremendous stressor. And so the worry that I have is that we take for granted that relationships will just kind of take care of themselves. That's another myth, I think. I used to have that, you know, when I was in my 20s, I have my friends from elementary school and middle school and college, and they'll always be there. They're my good friends, right? It turns out that friendships wither and die, not because there's anything wrong with the relationships, but just because they get neglected. So my worry is about that trend toward neglect of interpersonal well-being and connection in the service of, you know, career achievement, making a lot of money, becoming famous.
And how do you think friendships evolve as we age in terms of, I'll give the example. In my experience, I have work to do on keeping in touch with people. I'm generally so busy with work and family, I haven't been good, and I need to do a better job there. But also what I found is there are some relationships that just run their course over time, and others can last.
I think that's absolutely right, that it's not as though every relationship needs to last, because if you think about it, we're constantly changing. We're constantly developing as children and then as adults, what we care about, what we gravitate toward, right? So if you think about any two people in a relationship, each person is constantly changing. So it stands to reason that people would grow apart, that they would just cease to have as much in common. That's not a problem. And so it's not a problem to let some people go from your life. I think it's it's less common, but certainly happens, that people hold on to relationships over a long time. One of my oldest friends from kindergarten is someone I'm still very much in touch with, because there's something about, you know, we will argue about something that happened in the third grade, and our wives just think this is hilarious. And, you know, but there's something about having this guy who I've known since we were both tiny that matters, that feels good. He probably wouldn't be my friend now. We live in very different worlds, but we kind of hold on to it because nobody knew me when I was this little chubby 5-year-old.
So bringing it back to the study, was there a person or a family that stood out that just seemed to have the happiness secret sauce, where they were just so darn happy from, you know, as they age from generation to generation? Did such a family or a person exist in the study?
Yes, and more than one. But we track one life through a lot of the book, a man that we call Leo. We disguise the names and the details because we want to protect everyone's privacy in the study. These are real people. But Leo was our happiest man. And for a while, the study staff thought he was our most boring man because he wasn't a high achiever. He was just a good guy who was a high school teacher and took care of his family and had three kids and a pretty happy marriage and loved his students and really enjoyed his fellow teachers and loved to sail. And he had what we would think of as a pretty regular, non-distinguished life. And just a great guy, a loving man, nothing special.
So you say nothing special. Do you think, I think that where I'm going is, you know, genetics, DNA, happiness baselines. You think he had some special genetic secret sauce, if you will, that just set him apart from the rest? Because he sounds like a really nice, simple guy.
Well, he wasn't simple. He was real smart, but simple in that sense.
I don't mean simple in that way. Simple in that sense.
Yes. Yeah. No, and I think, you know, your question is important because I think temperamentally, we're all born with different temperaments. I mean, it sounds like you have more than one child, right?
We have two little girls.
Yeah. So you know they're born with somewhat different temperaments, right?
Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. You're like, we had two very different boys, right? And like, so you know that some of this is inborn, and we know that that's the case, and that some of this really does depend on the kind of temperament you're born with. But also then it's the match between the temperament you're born with and the environment you find yourself in. And that match seems to be really important in how you do.
So on that note, if Leo was the happiest man, was there a case where you looked at this person or family and said, I don't know why this person's so unhappy. I don't get it.
Yes, there was. There was. And often what would happen is we would look back at their childhood and see that they had had some big traumas and that did make a difference. But sometimes they were just unhappy. They were just not very good with other people. They were cranky and they thought that life wasn't very good. There are, you know, if you think about Winnie the Pooh, there are Tiggers and there are Eeyores, right? And Eeyore was just this gloomy guy and everything was kind of sad. And we had people like that in our study.
What role does optimism play?
Optimism, we know, actually helps people feel better about their lives, but it's chicken and egg, right? So you can cultivate optimism, but some of that at least is temperamental, we believe. So some people are more naturally optimistic than others. We do know that optimism, at least in research studies, plays a role in well-being.
And so in terms of the studies, there's obviously the Harvard study. Where is that study going in the future? And more generally, where would you like to see the science go on happiness?
Well, we're collecting data even as we speak. We've gone back to our children, the second generation, most of whom are baby boomers. And we're collecting information, particularly about how they fared during the pandemic, during lockdown. And we're also collecting information about their social media use. And so we try to stay current, right? And
anything you can share or too early to share?
Too early. We don't have the data yet. But so that's what we're doing. We don't know where the study is going to go after that, but we're still. The lights are still on. The doors are open. We're still collecting data.
I could venture a guess that there's a disproportionate relationship between frequency of social media use and happiness.
Well, we'll see. We don't know.
So in terms of your own life, what have you changed since writing this book?
Well, even before writing the book, it was when I began to understand all of these findings about how important relationships are in our lives. I began to notice that, you know, I could just work all the time. I'm a Harvard professor. I could work nonstop, right? And, you know, so I began to sort of say to myself, okay, who have I not seen in a while? Who do I want to make sure I'm connected to? And I will like text people and say, do you want to go for a walk? Or do you want to have a cup of coffee? Do you want to have lunch? And I, even during the pandemic, even during lockdown, we'd take walks outside. And so what I've done is I've made myself be more aware and nurture social connections. It's in the book, we called it social fitness, this idea that like physical fitness, you need to exercise those social muscles. And I've done it more and more for myself as I've done this research.
And so in closing, other than pick up the book, that's a fantastic read. I encourage everyone to go get it. What's one thing everyone should do starting today?
First, take stock of what you have in your relationships, right? Like, do you have enough people to have fun with, or someone at least to confide in, or someone who will give you a ride to the doctor when you need it, whatever it might be? What do you need, and what do you have in your life? And then think about, well, what would I like a bit more of? And then see if you can think about ways to cultivate that with people you already have in your life, or to develop new relationships in some of these small ways. So, like, even now, you know, one challenge I could give to your listeners is, right now, think of somebody you haven't seen and you kind of miss and think you'd like to connect with. Take out your phone and just send them a little text saying, I was just thinking of you and wanted to say hi. Just do that and see what comes back. That's like a small thing you could do, take you 30 seconds, and it's a way to start, you know, that social fitness routine.
I love it. I'm going to do it right now. Bob, thank you so much.
This was a pleasure. Thank you, Jason.